Good afternoon. I call this meeting of Human Services Finance Committee to order. Members, please have a seat. We have a quorum present. I will begin with the approval of the minutes for February 20, 2024. Vice Chair Barnes, do you want to move the approval for the minutes for February 20, 2024?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would be delighted to move the minutes from February 20, 2024.
Vice Chair Barnes moves the approval of minutes for February 20, 2024. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. The minutes for February 2024 are now approved. Members, we have two agenda items. The first one is the Office of Addiction and Recovery, will be followed by House File 2000. With that, I wanted to welcome the Director of Office of Addiction and Recovery, Mr. Jeremy Draker, to the testify table. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you may begin the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Jeremy Drucker. I'm the director of the Office of Addiction and Recovery and an assistant commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. Just before I begin my presentation, just a couple of prefatory remarks. The presentation you have in front of you, I added a few slides at the last minute. They're just kind of an overview of the current state of the substance use disorder landscape here in Minnesota. So we will get that. I'll work with Sean to get that with to you to have a complete packet after this. But just so you know, the first couple slides will not be in your packet as we go forward. And with that, I will just jump in. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be here and talk about my work and talk about the office and talk about how we really look forward to our partnership with our partners at the legislature. So as I said, my name is Jeremy Drucker. I'm the director of the Office of Addiction and Recovery. And just real quick to just kind of set the table around what the substance use disorder landscape looks like here in Minnesota. You know, substance use disorder has huge impacts on individuals, on families, on communities. I think we all know that. It's why I'm here. It's why my position exists. You know, and in addition to the emotional and social impact, it has a tremendous financial cost. In 2019, the Minnesota Department of Health did a study that looked at alcohol use and what excessive drinking costs Minnesotans, and found that it was nearly $8 billion a year through loss of productivity, healthcare, and other costs. And so there's a huge economic cost in addition to the emotional and the social impacts that substance use disorder has. And also, as you look at sort of what the primary substance use in adult for Minnesotans, you'll see when it comes to treatment admissions, alcohol is still far and away the most abused substance in Minnesota. And so really, while a lot of our discussions around opioids and the crisis of the opioid epidemic, which is absolutely critical and is just devastating many of our communities, I think it's important to remember that alcohol use still has a lot of negative consequences for Minnesotans. And then just to kind of set the table, too, to get a sense of the scope of what we're talking about here. But in 2021, about 55,000 people in Minnesota were admitted to a substance use disorder treatment program. Nationally, there are statistics that show that only about 1 in 4 people who need treatment access it. So I think, you know, we could safely times that number by a multiple to get to what the full impact of for folks in Minnesota. On substance use, for opioids in particular, I think, you know, in 2022, according to SAMHSA, about 6.1 million Americans 12 or older had an opioid use disorder. And when we look at the impact here in Minnesota, what we see is from 2020 to 2022, just a huge increase in opioid deaths, and especially when you look at 2018, 2019 to 2022, those deaths have really skyrocketed. And that really corresponded with when what we call fentanyl hit the tipping point in the illicit drug market. So when fentanyl took off, we saw that those drug overdoses took off as well. And I think that's really important as we think about the strategies that we're using here in Minnesota to combat opioid addiction. Fentanyl really changed the whole drug landscape here in Minnesota and nationally, I think, in a way that we're still reckoning with as a system. And we are responding to that, but it means that there's new treatment modalities coming online. There's new ways that we're addressing treatment. And so just want to set that as a kind of a basic understanding as we move forward with the rest of the presentation. looking at the population impacts around substance use disorder and opioids in particular, you know, there are some, you know, Minnesota is a great place to live. I'm very proud to be a Minnesotan born and bred, and we are rightfully very proud of a lot of our quality of life. But we also know that we just have some significant disparities in this state as well. And those disparities that we see in education, in other areas, are also the same that we see in drug overdoses. So Native American Minnesotans are dying at over 9 times the rate of white Minnesotans. Black Minnesotans are dying at over 3 times the rate of white Minnesotans. And so really being cognizant as we do this work about how do we make sure that everyone in Minnesota, no matter their background, no matter their zip code, no matter where they're from, all have access to quality treatment, recovery, and prevention opportunities. Breaking that down a little more too, though, when we look at some other populations that are impacted significantly by overdoses, 1 out of 5 overdoses since 2015 occurred with an individual who was released from a correctional facility within the previous year. That's a really high number, and I think it's something that when we think about ways to intervene and opportunities that the state has in order to address the opioid epidemic, these are individuals who are incarcerated either in a jail or a prison. That's an opportunity for an intervention, and so I'll be talking a little bit more about that later as well. And then also 1 out of 10 Minnesotans who are experiencing homelessness, one out of 10 of the overdoses are from individuals who are homeless. So another just kind of getting a sense of who is really bearing the brunt of a lot of this epidemic. So just some key takeaways. You know, in 2022, we saw overdose deaths after they were spiking from 2019 to 2021. They did level off a little bit in 2022. We are watching that number really closely and waiting to see kind of how things go from here on out. But that is a trend that we've seen nationally as well. Nationally, overdoses also began to level out. So, you know, speculation is that the increased access to naloxone or Narcan has really helped prevent unnecessary overdose deaths. But really wanting to dig into those factors a little more and make sure that trend starts curving downwards. I would say that of those overdose deaths, 75% of the overdose deaths in Minnesota involved at least one opioid. You know, prescription opioids were once a huge factor in overdose deaths. Now it's fentanyl. And so fentanyl is involved in 92% of overdose deaths in Minnesota. And again, just, you know, to reiterate that the drug landscape is changing. Fentanyl right now, as I mentioned, is really the biggest worry that I personally have on the street when it comes to illicit drugs. But more and more, we're seeing adulterants like xylazine, which is an animal tranquilizer that's now combined with fentanyl in many cases. And that is just a really nasty drug that causes the necrosis, which is the rotting of the flesh and can lead to amputations. And it's just a really nasty piece of business. And so the drug landscape is always changing. I see Representative Baker here. Him and I have had some conversations about this and just how do, you know, from his position on ORAC and my position, how do we respond to such a fluid crisis? And so I think that's just an important thing to be aware of. And then the last thing I would just say before I jump into sort of the work that I'm doing specifically is that as bad as things are right now in terms of what we're seeing with the drug epidemic, you know, there are treatments and interventions that are proven to be very effective. One of them in particular is medications for opioid use disorder. So we use the phrase MOUD for short for that because we're in government and we love acronyms. But these are FDA-approved drugs that, in combination with counseling and behavioral health therapies, are proven to reduce the impacts of substance use disorder for folks. And so these are drugs like methadone, Suboxone, Naltrexone. Those are the three main ones. There are variations of them, but those are some key interventions that have really proven to reduce deaths and to really improve outcomes for folks with opioid use disorder. But in response to this crisis, which has been brewing for a while here in Minnesota, the governor and the legislature in 2022 created a subcabinet on opioid substance use and addiction. This was really created, one of the things that the governor has really made a priority, and the legislature I think as well, is really looking at some of these sticky issues that that cross different agencies to create subcabinets to really address them. So whether it's the children's cabinet, whether it's the climate change subcabinet, whether it's the Interagency Council on Homelessness, really making a concerted effort to reduce sort of the silos between state agencies and really bring them together in what we call these sub-cabinets to really take a holistic approach that crosses different agencies to really make sure that we're coordinated and doing the best we can to address that issue. And so the Subcabinet on Opioid Substance Use and Addiction, which was created in 2022, it includes the Departments of Human Services, Health, Education, Higher Education, Management and Budget, Corrections, Public Safety, and the Interagency Council on Homelessness. We've also sort of informally adopted the Department of Commerce into the Subcabinet, just given their role regulating the private insurance market and just recognizing just the power that power is a great word, that our payers in the private healthcare space have, so managed care organizations and other payers. They also created in 2022 my position, the position of Addiction and Recovery Director, to chair that subcabinet. In addition to that legislation, there was a Governor's Advisory Council on Opioid Substance Use and Addiction that was created. And my role, in addition to chairing the subcabinet, is to co-lead that advisory council. And so you'll see the members of that advisory council there on the screen to the right. But many of these individuals are people with lived experience with substance use disorder, whether themselves, their family. Many of them have experience in incarceration as well. And so they really serve as an advisory body to advise the subcabinet and to really be a sounding board for us as we're developing policies and really looking at what's going to impact the lives of Minnesotans. So last year was their inaugural year, so I should add that I began, while this position was created in 2022, I began my appointment in January of 2023. So last year was really the inaugural year for this entire effort. And so the Governor's Advisory Council, they in January released a year-end report out with some legislative recommendations around justice-involved populations in particular. I mentioned them a little earlier. You can read that report. There's a link in your packet here, but also in an appendix to this presentation, there's just a bulleted list of some of those recommendations, and we're always happy to have conversations about that, and I can certainly put you in touch with the chair, Beth Elstad, or the vice chair, Colin Cash. 2022 created the subcabinet, created the Governor's Advisory Council, created my position. Last year, in conversations with the legislature and some other folks, this was really just a tremendous amount of work for one individual to lead just on their own. And so last year, there was funding for an Office of Addiction and Recovery to help lead the work of, or to help staff the work of the subcabinet, the Governor's Advisory Council, and some other related bodies. And I'll show a slide that gives a visual representation of what this looks like. But essentially what that funding does, it funds my position, it funds a deputy for me, it funds a position to really focus on adolescent substance misuse. We know that the more we can get ahead of these issues, the better, and certainly making sure that our kids are getting the services and the support that they need to make healthy life decisions. And if they do have a substance misuse issue, we can address that and really to focus on that area. And then also a project coordinator just to help with logistics and managing the meetings and whatnot. So the core functions of the Office of Addiction and Recovery, many of them are lifted straight from the statute that created my position, but really looking to work across state government to break down silos. This last one I'm going to come back to again, or this next one I'll come back to again later, but to coordinate and align efforts across state government with our city, county, and tribal partners. This committee is well aware that we have a state-supervised, county-administered human services system. There are a lot of different players in this space, a lot of different funding streams, a lot of different mechanisms by which we can address this issue. And so really making sure that all of us are working in concert together is a key priority of my office. Also conducting robust public engagement to build relationships with communities and community leaders to ensure people with direct experience kind of drive our efforts. That was part of the legislation as well, that making sure that there are people with lived experience were part of this conversation as we're developing policies. There's a phrase that's used in the disability community or the disability community, but is something that I think can be applied to many different places, but sort of nothing about us without us. And so this is an attempt to really live that value. I should add that I'm a person in long-term recovery myself, and so it's really important for me personally to make sure that I'm connecting with other people with lived experience. My lived experience with substance use is very different than someone else's lived experience with substance use. Depends on a lot of factors. We're really talking about the complexity of a whole individual here. And so really getting those diverse perspectives part of the policymaking process is something that we want to make sure that we're doing. Also, we're really looking at what are the new interagency opportunities to sort of leverage different systems to address addiction treatment and recovery. Part of my role as a chair of a subcabinet, it's not to replace the work that the Department of Human Services is doing. It's not to replace the work that the Department of Health is doing, not to replace the work that the work of the Department of Corrections. But what are the opportunities that arise when we're talking about substance use and our correctional facilities? What are the opportunities that arise when we're talking about substance use in our schools? And so really helping bring those different subject matter experts together to really make sure that we're taking advantage of opportunities to work across agencies. Again, promoting innovative programs that are demonstrating results. In my past, I worked at the Department of Human Services in the Medicaid area, but also in the Commissioner's Office. I know very much what it's like for state agency employees who are running programs to just, that takes up a lot of time just to run the program, and you don't always have the opportunity to have that wide lens of what's going on in New York, what's going on in California, what's going on in other places. And so one of the things that my office tries to do is keep an eye on what are the really promising opportunities that exist nationally, make sure that our agency partners are aware of what's going on and we're taking advantage of any opportunity there that can improve improve our services for Minnesotans. And then the final thing is, again, while we don't run programs, we are not a funding entity, all of our work is really done through state agencies. We do provide oversight to programs and strategies to make sure that they're working well. And so if there's a problem that a constituent or a stakeholder is having with a particular program at an agency or whatnot, we certainly want to hear about it, and we want to make sure that we can help resolve that and come to a good outcome no matter what that is. So those are some of the things that we do on a daily basis. But to get more specific, this is kind of what the governance structure looks like, just to kind of reiterate. We've got the Governor's Advisory Council, the subcabinet. We've got action teams, which I'll say a little more about in a bit about what those are and how those function. But you'll see underneath sort of supporting all of those entities is the Office of Addiction and Recovery. I talked about coordination earlier, and part of our functions is coordination. So this is a really important thing that we're working, that we do, is to really make sure that we're having strategic alignment between the One Minnesota Plan, which is the governor's strategic plan for the state, the legislature, what you all are thinking, what you all are driving on, what you all are hearing from your constituents and your communities and policies that you're pushing, what our tribal, county, and local level efforts are doing, what the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council is doing. Representative Baker has been very gracious by inviting me to the ORAC meetings, and so I sit on those every month. And again, especially I think that's a good example, too, of when we look at the different efforts that are out there. When we look at opioid settlement funds in particular, 75% of those funds are going to county and local governments, 25% of them are going to the state. So really, Representative Baker and I have had these conversations, how are we making sure that we're aligned? How are we making sure that we're coordinated, recognizing and respecting the jurisdictions of our county, local, and tribal partners, but also making sure that we're sharing information and we're working in concert. We certainly know that resources in this space are precious, and we want to make sure that we're utilizing those resources to their utmost impact. And then finally, federal strategy. What are opportunities that are arising from the federal government, either in the form of grants from SAMHSA, opportunities through CMS for new waiver opportunities through Medicaid? What are opportunities there that we may want to take advantage of? And then again, how do we communicate that across all of these different entities to really drive collaboration and cohesion and a shared strategic direction? So that's sort of like the principles, the outlines, the functions of what we do to really get maybe more specific in some of the things that we've been involved with in particular in this last year. So I mentioned public engagement is a really important part of this work. We work with many community partners who invite us into their communities to hear directly from them about what they're experiencing related to substance use and opioids. So we worked with the American Indian CD Advisory Council this summer and participated in a American Indian SUD Summit up at Fond du Lac in August. We worked with one of our council members in the East African community to do a listening session in the East African community in Cedar Riverside back in August. We did a listening session in North Minneapolis in December. We're working on some additional events. We're doing a law enforcement opioid summit in March with some of our law enforcement leaders to really talk about the relationship and how we can foster better cooperation and collaboration there. So we do a lot of different public engagement. We've also been working quite a bit on naloxone distribution. So many of you know what naloxone is. It's the drug, it's the anti-overdose drug. Many of you know it in its nasal form, Narcan, but it can also be administered with a needle. We say IM or intramuscular for short. And so naloxone distribution is a huge anti-overdose effort. You know, last year the legislature passed a bill that required naloxone in schools, jails, treatment centers with law enforcement and some other congregate settings. Funding did not come with that, but we were able to work with our state agency partners at the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services to create a centralized naloxone distribution portal that's provided free naloxone to those mandated groups. That portal has now been expanded as well. We were able to use some federal dollars to pay for that. And so that portal has now been expanded to include tribes, syringe service providers, and then also other organizations that work with homeless Minnesotans. So we want to make sure that no one ever, there's never an overdose that happens because someone didn't have Narcan or naloxone. And so this is an effort to achieve what we call naloxone saturation, or basically to get it in the hands of the people who need it in the format and quantity that they need it most. The other thing that we're doing on naloxone distribution is myself and some other state officials had a chance to go to a naloxone saturation academy this summer with SAMHSA. This was 10 states that were all sharing best practices around how to get naloxone to everybody who needs it. And we walked out of that that conference really fully recognizing that we did not have a clear picture of what the naloxone distribution landscape looks like here in Minnesota. We've used what we call a hub and spoke model previously for naloxone distribution. This means that the state and other local governments and entities and federal grants would fund local organizations to then go purchase naloxone, but we didn't really have good insight into where it was ending up, who was getting it. And so we really, and with all of the new opportunities around naloxone, we really wanted to get a better sense of what that landscape looks like, and especially how this new centralized distribution portal interacts with all of that. And so Minnesota Management and Budget is doing a landscape analysis at the moment to really get a picture of what that naloxone distribution landscape looks like. And then we're gonna have a naloxone saturation convening in May with all of our partners to share that information, to really have a discussion together about what's the best way to optimize our naloxone distribution system here in Minnesota. Another big thing we're working on is a One Minnesota SUD goal. I'll say a little more about that in a moment, but really that's just incorporating the work of the sub-cabinet into the state strategic plan. I mentioned interagency coordination. There'll be some information later about some of the great investments that were passed last session to address substance use. They all fall, many of them fall into different agencies. DHS got a bunch, MDH got a bunch. There's stuff from the adult use cannabis bill. And so really making sure that we're optimizing those investments is a big priority of the work that we're doing. And so really kind of upping our game when it comes to lines of sight and coordination in terms of investments across the administration. Another one that we're really interested in working on is recovery-friendly workplaces. So we know that a great, sort of one of my goals is that recovery is as easy to find as drugs. Like, you're for people who have experienced substance use, oftentimes in 20 minutes you know where you could go to find a substance. We want recovery to be as easy to find as that too. And so one of the places that we can really reach people and provide support and services in is in workplaces. And so the Department of Health got some funding last year to create a recovery-friendly workplace initiative, and so my office is really highly engaged with them in rolling out that program. I mentioned connections between law enforcement and human services. I think this last week, I think we've all, been reminded just the sacrifices that our first responders make in keeping us all safe. They also have a tremendous role in addressing substance use. The Department of Corrections estimates that 90% of their population has a substance use disorder, so you can imagine how much that impacts what our law enforcement colleagues are experiencing when they're out on the street. And so Many of them are really passionate about this issue, and so really working with them to figure out how we can support their work and connect them to resources to make their jobs easier and to provide better services for folks who are struggling as well. And then finally, budget development and implementation. Kind of goes without saying, but part of my role is to serve as a principal advisor on this topic to the governor, and so I'm heavily involved in a lot of budget development and policy implementation. Quick overview of the last legislative session. So the last legislative session, you know, many amazing things were passed. One thing that I was very excited about personally, because it's my issue area, that over 4 years, over $200 million was invested in addressing substance use. You know, many of these proposals were really focused on reducing those disparities that I mentioned earlier, but those investments really crossed in the entire spectrum of services that we refer to as the continuum of care for substance use. So prevention, harm reduction, treatment, and recovery. Again, many of those investments also looked at the intersection of substance use with housing, healthcare, and other supports. But overall, I think when you step back and look at it from a global perspective, I think what you look at is you see that we really moved Minnesota more towards a public health approach to substance use disorder that I think is really something that we've heard as a positive approach from our law enforcement colleagues, from many of our colleagues that we work with on a day-to-day basis. Some of the highlights, and I'm not going to go through each one of these in particular, but I just want you to have this in your packet. These are just some of the highlights that we passed, you know, really looking at how we can support family startup and capacity building grants, how we can support our providers who are providing treatment, supporting peer recovery specialists and recovery community organizations. Overdose Prevention and Morbidity Act that went to the Department of Health is an ongoing source of funding that's really going to provide a whole suite of really valuable services to Minnesota, including drug surveillance. So helping to know at any given time, like, what does the drug makeup look like on the street? What do we see? How much is fentanyl, xylazine, cocaine, methamphetamine? Much of what we're seeing these days too is polysubstance, so it's a fancy word for there's just a lot of stuff mixed together. And so the Overdose Prevention and Morbidity Act funds really important surveillance techniques to make sure that we know what we're dealing with on the street. And then there's other investments too to support individuals with SUD in housing, supporting our kids with behavioral health grants. And then there was a significant chunk of funding out of the adult use cannabis bill to just address any unintended consequences that may come from the legalization of adult use cannabis. So, you know, as you look through this, if you ever look at it again, feel free to reach out to my office. We're always happy to talk about any one of these policies or proposals as they get implemented. I mentioned earlier the One Minnesota goal. So one of the ways in which the governor organizes the work of state government and really sets a strategic direction and a plan is through what we call One Minnesota Goals. The Substance Use Disorder One Minnesota Goal, they're really targeted, focused metrics, so it doesn't encompass the totality of the work, but it's really about let's focus on one goal, one metric, and then let's come up with it with a really detailed plan on how to get there. And so the goal for my work is to reduce the impact of the opioid crisis on Minnesotans, their families, and their communities. How we're going to measure this goal is the number of opioid deaths in Minnesota. So we want to see that. We want to see the number of opioid deaths in Minnesota go down. And the target is a 5% reduction in overdose deaths over a three-year horizon. One of the reasons, there's a lot of discussion that goes into how we choose the metric and what the target is. I think one of the conversations we had around this goal was there are so many factors that go into overdose deaths. We don't know what the drugs are going to look like in the street next year. We don't know what other environmental factors like, you know, economic factors. Will there be a recession? Will that lead to layoffs? Will there be a pandemic? Will that lead to, people, having to huddle up and an increase in mental health and substance use? But nonetheless, we thought that was an important goal that we should strive for, and really, again, trying to bend that curve downwards. The way that we're really focused on achieving that goal is through what we call action teams. So my office acts as a convener. We're really focused in kind of going back to that information I shared at the beginning around where we're seeing a high prevalence of overdose deaths. So we've formed action teams to really focus in on specific populations and really work on strategies to conduct overdose prevention activities. And so includes unsheltered individuals, includes justice-involved individuals, and includes adolescents. And then there's focus areas within each one of those action teams. Again, on our end at the executive branch, how we organize our work is just a critical step in making sure that we're moving forward with progress and we're having measurable results. So this is how we're organizing the work of the sub-cabinet around the SUD goal. Specifically around the justice involved and SUD work, really looking at how do we increase access to those medicines for opioid use disorder that I spoke about earlier in jails and prisons, looking at things like the 1115 reentry waiver opportunity. When we think about coordination with those different multiple layers of government, I think this is an example of this is a federal opportunity that will allow us to draw down Medicaid funds to help pay for individuals up to 90 days pre-release from incarceration to provide necessary services and supports for addiction. Also creating a work group to identify additional barriers to accessing medicines for opioid use disorder in jails and prisons. And then also, how do we support better transitions into and out of jails and prisons, the use of emerging professions like peer support and community health workers, but then also, you know, what are some innovative things that are happening around Minnesota? One of those is what we call an officer-involved community-based care coordination model. Mankato and Blue Earth County are doing something really cool in this area. It's called the Yellow Line Project, where it's really linking law enforcement and behavioral health providers to provide services to individuals that when law enforcement experience somebody having a behavioral health crisis, they are linked to services immediately. The state actually did a study on that recently and found that it reduced recidivism by 17%, and there is a significant uptake in services provided to those individuals. So again, how can we expand things like that to other areas of the state? Unsheltered and SUD, you know, we are focusing on working really closely with our colleagues at the Interagency Council of Homelessness, who have developed what they call a justice plan. This is a plan that's been 2 years in the making, and there are some really specific strategies around addressing homelessness and SUD. And so we're really, our action team here is really taking on that work and spearheading that piece of the work. And then also, as part of my role, the governor has asked me to be involved in working on some solutions to incurring current encampment issues. So really partnering with our county and city partners on what a multi-jurisdictional response that would look like that includes housing and substance use options for Minnesotans that are living in encampments right now. And then finally, the Adolescent Substance Misuse Action Team. This is just getting up and going. I was just able to hire an individual to help lead this work. And where we're at right now with that is just really inventorying the activities across the administration and identifying gaps and opportunities. So you'll see here just a couple examples of how these are scattered across different agencies. You've got collegiate recovery and student basic needs. When we think of adolescents, we think of 10 to 24 in terms of brain development. So college is really an important place where we're addressing substance use. Recovery secondary schools, some of the community-based prevention campaigns at MDH, and the list goes on. And so happy to take any questions on this or anything else I've presented on, but that's just kind of a really quick overview of the work that I've been doing and would just really be eager to partner with you going forward as we try to serve Minnesotans better. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Director and Assistant Commissioner, for the presentation. I think, members, this is the work that we did last session and the investment that we made to address the substance use disorder, and we'll encourage for people to look through and to be able to provide guidance. Thank you to Representative Baker for all the help in that process. So, discussions. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Drucker, for being here today, and Mr. Chair. So you touched a little bit on it, and I know this is kind of top of mind. It's been a curiosity question for some time, but it also came up yesterday. I was presenting a bill on online safety for children, and one of the testifiers that came forward was a mother who had lost her child. He had purchased something that he thought was a pain medication online, but it was actually laced with fentanyl. Unfortunately, that child did not make it. But it brought me to what I think you were referring to as the basically combination drugs, right, where folks are getting something that they may not intend or realize is laced with fentanyl. And I'm just curious, in the data, do we have any sense of how big of a portion that is on deaths?
Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Representative. I have colleagues here from the Department of Health, and we can get back to you with like a more specific number, but we have a general sense of what the landscape looks like. We know from conversations with law enforcement who deal with this kind of in an immediate way, and there's also a program at the Department of Health that is a partnership with law enforcement where they actually test actual drug samples that are seized. But we know that cocaine, fentanyl, and I've had the same experience. I mean, one of the most really profound parts of this job is meeting with parents who have lost children. And I met with a family, you know, their daughter purchased what they thought was a different substance. It's just like you said. You know, I think it's a significant problem. I would say this is the one thing that scares me the most, is just that not knowing aspect. And that's just the danger of this illegal drug market and the illicit drug market is we don't know what's in these substances. And so we do know that many of the substances that are out there, whether it's methamphetamine or cocaine, even marijuana sometimes, is laced with fentanyl. And even fentanyl is laced with xylazine, which I mentioned xylazine earlier. And it's a fluid landscape. But I can work with my colleagues at the Department of Health to see if we can get you an exact number, but it is substantial.
Vice Chair Barna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That is very helpful. I mean, I continue to think about how that works simply because I know, you know, when we're talking about potentially a large segment of folks who really are unaware that what they are getting. Now, I would argue that probably we shouldn't be buying things that we don't know what they are off the internet as a good safety tip. But that said, I do suspect there's a lot of folks who are finding these substances that are a mixture without having any concept of what they are. And maybe that's an education campaign, but I'd really love to know more about the data behind how prevalent that is. So if you can work with our friends to get that data, it would be really, really helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative. And I might also just add too that to that point, drug checking is a really important part of overdose prevention. So fentanyl test strips are legalized, are legal xylazine test strips. We're able to make some investments in what are called FTIR. Don't ask me what that stands for, but it's a really sophisticated, exact way of testing substances. So really working with our community partners, our partners in law enforcement, our partners in the departments to really make sure that drug testing supplies are out there for folks. Just so exactly as you say, if someone does purchase a substance, there's an opportunity to test it so at least they have a sense of what it is before they put it in their body.
Thank you so much, Assistant Commissioner. Also, we made some investment in public awareness about substance use disorder in the last session. Representative Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you, Jeremy. Thank you. I hope I can call you that. We work together a lot, and from your standpoint, again, and to Representative Bonner, we hear these stories a lot about losing kids because they took a pill they thought was what it was, something different. They even take a half a pill and it kills them. I guess, as my friends and colleagues on this committee in human services, do me a favor, because we all talk to our kids at different places in our own districts, right? We talk about this with classrooms, and we do this all the time. We don't think about this, but please do me a favor and just tell those children, if they're high school or under, don't ever take a pill that doesn't have your name on it on a pill bottle, and don't ever touch anything on the internet because it's not real. We just have to say it simple like that because it's important. I think Jeremy and I, sorry, Mr. Drucker and I are always working on these kind of issues, and it's constantly, and we do a ton in prevention education and tons of things in the schools, and we have volunteer groups that are going in here from moms who have lost children, and that's how this passion works. But we as a responsibility, I think, because we know this, we hear this long presentation that's important, but we need to share that. I just want to say one thing. you've been really open for business for about a year. I need to ask you, because I haven't asked you this, though, what have you found as an aha moment that you have realized that we were not doing well because of your creation of the office? What has really kind of said, dang it, I guess I'm really glad we're doing this, or have you found it yet? Because a lot of things that you're talking about, as a legislator, I was assuming was already happening. When Commissioner Harp said, wanted to open up this office, I said, do we really need to do this? We really need to spend this money? They should be doing this already. It's just more meetings, more meetings, more meetings. But I'm hoping, and maybe we're not there yet, and maybe it is early, because I've seen you do a lot of good things. You are really passionate about this. What have you seen in your work that has brought us better and closer with your sub-cabinet communications, or what have you found so far, if you could share that with us?
Assistant Commissioner.
Yeah, thank you, Representative. You know, if I had to pick one thing, I mean, I could probably talk about a couple things, but I think if to say one thing, I think it is really creating and evaluating and getting like a really comprehensive inventory across the administration and across the executive branch about what every agency is doing in a very like granular sense. And so what I mean by that is we had a lot of good conversation and collegiality at the leadership levels and departments, commissioner to commissioner, assistant commissioner to assistant commissioner, even director to director in many places. I think with the sub-cabinet, what I found with the sub-cabinet is you have an opportunity to really create staff-to-staff level connections across the enterprise to really help, you know, line staff at the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services and the Department of Education fully understand what it is that their colleagues are doing and how their work intersects with that. And so we've had a lot of really good conversations around adolescent substance misuse in particular, and I'll give you a really good example is, you know, there's research out there that shows that if you're connected to a recovery community for 7 years, your chances of returning to use are minimal. If you are a young person in, you know, eighth grade, you know, ninth grade, you know, dealing with a substance use issue, you can go to a recovery school funded by the Department of Education. What are some of the supports that are outside of school that can support you? And then as you go to college, you know, you go to Augsburg, which has a great step-up program and is helped funded through collegiate recovery. So there are these different programs that exist in different state agencies. Not every state agency and those line staff are fully cognizant of all of the different connection points. And so being able to bring together those line staff and those folks who are in the kind of the bowels of the agency doing the work every day, managing the grants, understanding what each other's colleagues are doing, I think is really providing a lot of really strong opportunities for collaboration and optimizing and becoming more efficient in those investments. And then the last thing I would just say too, in my experience, I think this 1115 reentry waiver opportunity is a really significant opportunity for the state. Really being able to drive that from my perch, sort of sitting outside of an agency and working with colleagues at the Department of Corrections, colleagues at the Department of Human Services, and really helping bring them together to have some really good conversations about what are the nuts and bolts of how services are delivered within a correctional setting, and how does that fit in with how we do Medicaid outside of a correctional setting, and what's the plumbing for how all these systems need to be combined in order to create a new program. And it's just created a lot of those aha moments of like, wow, you're doing this, or have you thought of this? And I think that's kind of the ground level work that provides opportunity going forward.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I also wanted to say thank you to Chair Stevenson, who was instrumental in terms of the Office of Addiction Recovery. I'm glad that he's sitting here listening, particularly focused on the youth. So thank you so much for that presentation, too. Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a couple questions that I have in mind. I'm hoping to have a discussion at a later time, too, and just follow up on things that I'm interested in right now, particularly through education. Being one of my committees. If you could just address again kind of on one of your slides, slide 9, the legislative overview, you talked about the last point being that the legislature was moving towards a public health approach to substance use disorder. And could you maybe expand on that, what that means in terms of, you know, especially as we coordinate and choose our budgets and choose our where we're going to focus our time, having a public health mindset on what we're doing. What does that mean, and what's the value of it?
Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Representative, Mr. Chair. So I think what I see is that is, you know, historically we've tended to criminalize addiction. There are a lot of unpleasant, quite frankly, illegal behaviors that stem from substance use, and we've approached that historically from a law enforcement perspective, from a punishment perspective. And I think that over time, as we've learned more, there's a saying, you know, when you know better, you do better. I think as we've learned more, we've moderated that approach in many different ways. And I see that in my interactions with law enforcement, many of them are incredibly enlightened in this area in terms of understanding what is the realm of their ability to deal with some of these issues. But to give you a really specific example, I think something we did last session that I think of as right-sizing our laws around this is that we increased some of the penalties for fentanyl distribution, but we also decriminalized paraphernalia. And so the goal there was to make sure that we're not criminalizing a person who has a disease, but that we're also taking the steps that we need to take as a society to ensure that there's safety for the community, that there are guardrails around some of the behaviors that are acceptable. And so I think by doing that, we moved that line. And I think I might have talked to you about this at some point, Representative Baker, but I will be convinced, I don't know exactly where that line is between where you crack down hard on substance use and where you don't want to criminalize addiction, because it is a moving line. But I think moving more towards getting in the right zone to have those conversations, and they are conversations, in order to recognize that substance use is a disease, and that many individuals who are experiencing that disease, we should not criminalize that. And so I think we moved towards an approach where we're taking that understanding and meeting people where they're at, but also keeping those safeguards in place for society.
Just wanted to say thank you so much for all the work that you're doing for all of us and for the state of Minnesota, and all the lives that your coordination and partnership will save lives, and we need to do more in this area. Any closing remarks, Assistant Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Just to say, I'm really grateful for this opportunity to share what I'm working on, and just please know I have an open door policy. I'm happy to meet with any of you on anything related to my work, and happy to be a resource and a partner in just improving outcomes for Minnesotans. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. The next conversation is House File 2000, Chair Stevenson. I will move House File 2000 to be re-referred to the State Local Government Finance and Policy Committee. Welcome to the committee, Chair Stevenson. I think you want to also move the A18 amendment.
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. I just want to be on the list to talk about it.
Members, we have the A18 before us. I move A18 for adoption. Any discussion on A18 amendment? Lead New Burnley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if Chair Stevenson wanted to say anything, but to introduce it, or if I should just ask my question.
Chair Stevenson.
I wonder if it would be helpful, because this amendment is basically why the bill is in the committee, it might be helpful for me to kind of give opening remarks, and then we can talk about it at that point. Does that work for you, Mr. Chair? Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you for having the discussion that you had immediately before this. I was glad to be able to watch it, and it's really your leadership that has been really remarkable on tackling this very important issue with the state. But on the bill that's before this committee, House File 2000 legalizes sports betting in the state of Minnesota, and I'm not going to speak too much about the bill because it's here for a very narrow piece, but I do want members of the committee to know that people are wagering on sports every day in Minnesota right now. They're just doing it illegally. It's very easy to place an illegal bet on sports through offshore websites and other mechanisms. And this bill is largely in this committee because of the issue of problem gaming. And when you speak to people who work in the problem gaming field, they will tell you that they work with people who their problem gaming manifests itself in sports betting. So this is an issue I don't want there to be any confusion that we're going to go from a place where sports betting isn't happening to one place where it is happening. What this bill is about is taking illicit activity and trying to make it regulated, controlled, consumer-protected regime. So the bill does legalize sports betting, both the brick-and-mortar operations where you would physically go to a sports betting lounge and place your bet at a window, but also statewide mobile sports betting where you would bet on a phone or other mobile device or online through a platform, probably a platform that you're familiar with. You've heard the brand names for DraftKings, FanDuel, because there's a lot of advertising around this, so probably even if you don't care at all about sports, you're familiar with those particular companies. The current draft of the bill taxes sports betting at a 10% tax rate. It takes all of the funding generated from that, places in a special revenue account. First, we pay for the cost of regulation off the top in a fixed appropriation, and after doing that, we split the money. Half of it goes to tackle problem gaming, and half of it goes to fund youth sports, with a small portion of the money going to youth sports going to do what's called athlete integrity projects. So this would be educating like college athletes about risks about being involved in gambling and how that could impact their career in collegiate athletics. But the reason to this committee's attention is the first thing I mentioned, which is half of the money after you take out the administrative cost goes to combating problem gaming. And problem gaming is something I think is a very serious problem. I think that it's really good that the committee just had a discussion about substance use, because I think sometimes people don't think of problem gaming as addiction in the same way they think of being addicted to a substance as an addiction. And it's biologically the same thing, right? I mean, it's a similar, or maybe I should say similar, it's not the same, but it is the, it is an addiction, and it leads to the same bad outcomes that we see in addictions to substances. It's very serious, and it should be taken seriously. And I don't want anyone to think that just because I'm promoting legal sports betting that I think that problem gaming isn't a problem. I think it is a problem. I think that the way to deal with it is by addressing it honestly and devoting significant resources to it, which is what this bill does. So what the amendment does is it restructures how that money is allocated into basically three buckets. The first bucket is going through the national affiliate of the National Problem Gaming Group, and their work mostly focuses on education awareness. Sort of, I think of that as the prevention bucket. Then you have a third of the money going to the agency, to DHS, for treatment. And one significant policy change that's in this committee's purview occurs in Article 4, Section 2. We add families to where you would have treatment and programming available for. And that's important because we know, just as in the substance use place, it is it impacts beyond just the actual person who has the disorder. It includes the entire family. So making resources available to families is important. The third bucket is added in this amendment by having some funds available for emergency services grants. And I think of that as the downstream impact bucket, right? So like, we know that people who engage in sports betting, or I'm sorry, who have problem gaming, can have very bad outcomes from that, the same way that someone who has a substance use addiction can end up having downstream impact. And so that's what we're looking to fund with that third. So we have a third going to education prevention, a third going to treatment, and a third going to the downstream impacts. That's what the A18 amendment does, and that's what's before the committee.
Thank you so much, Chair Stevenson. Member discussion, Lead New Burnley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Stevenson, Chair Stevenson. I've got a couple of questions. I'm wondering, and I apologize, I should have dug through the fiscal note better, and I didn't. But I'm wondering, so you're adding through the amendment a blank appropriation to administer this portion. Do you know approximately what that appropriation will be? Obviously, we don't know exactly. It's based on tax revenue, but what's the do you know approximately what we anticipate there?
Chair Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, and I just want to clarify, this is not a new appropriation, it's a restructuring. So what was in the bill before was these funds would come from the general fund, but we want to make clear that it's coming from the special revenue fund that's established, that captures all of the tax revenue, was the idea. So administering the cost, the DHS's admin costs will now come from the special revenue fund and not from the general fund. That's the change. According to the fiscal note, and this is from last year, so kind of everything should move forward a year, but they had the cost at $68,024, $112,025, $424,026, and $531,027. Fiscal 24, 25, 26.
Lead New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And those are real numbers.
That's from their fiscal number.
But meaning real numbers, as in there's no extra zeros.
Right.
Okay,
Lainey Burley.
Just wanted to make sure I understand that. I just want to make sure I'm understanding, because it looks like on line 30 and 31, you don't change the language that of the amount remaining in the sports betting revenue account after these appropriations, then that money is used. That language remains, unless I've misread, but I think that language remains. And then in addition, but like you said, the appropriation is from the sports betting, from the special revenue account. And so it sounds like we're talking over the years, we're talking in the amount of 1 to 2 million in a biennium for this particular funding. Does that sound right? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes,
or are we talking around each other and stuff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brindley, I think we are talking around each other a little bit here. So let me try and be clear, and at the risk of giving you more information than you asked for. First of all, the language you're pointing to after the appropriation, that's the appropriation to regulate. So if you remember, I said that we capture all the money from sports betting, put it in the special revenue account. First, we do an appropriation to the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Revenue to actually regulate and administer sports betting. And that's the appropriation it's saying after in the lines of the bill.
What's left.
Yeah, so after you do that fixed appropriation, the money gets split half to problem gaming, half to amateur sports under this proposal. Then DHS has their own admin costs to deal with their piece of it, the problem gaming piece. And the lines in the amendment that include a blank appropriation, 1.4 to 1.5, that's what that blank appropriation is for. That's not the amount of money that goes to DHS for treatment. That's the amount of money that goes to administer their program, if that makes sense to you. So your question, I think, is how much money is going to go to treatment, which is not what I thought you were asking. So the numbers I grabbed for fiscal note.
I wasn't. I was clearly confused when I was asking it.
For treatment. under the fiscal note, they do have estimates here for the amount that goes to problem gaming of 1.6 million in 24, 3 million in 25, 7.7 million in 26, and 8.2 million in 27. Under the underlying bill that's before you, that money gets split 50-50 between the not-for-profit and the agency. Under the amendment, it goes a third, a third, a third between the not-for-profit, the agency, and ESP.
Lee Newbrinley, any follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was really helpful clarification. I really appreciate that. Okay, so, and theoretically, those numbers will continue to go up in the out years. Theoretically, I mean, I guess we don't know for sure, but theoretically, those numbers will go up. And do we have any sense right now of funding? Is there public funding right now for compulsive gambling treatment specifically, or will this be an entirely new appropriation? The public awareness campaign, I assume, is mostly new, or that maybe there's been one-time money in the past. But is there anything specifically now, or is this entirely
I think, Lee Newbrinley, we have that information. We'll go to non-partisan staff.
Mr. Byrne. Mr. Chair, Representative Newbrinley, there is existing statutory funding from existing legal gambling, not what's in this bill, but prior, which is distributed effectively the same way that Representative Stevenson's bill would. It's currently the two purposes, not the third one, which is coming in. And as of the November forecast, DHS was projected to get $6.977 million for the current biennium for treatment, and then they have $260,000 for the biennium for administration, but that's for existing legal gambling, not for the new portion.
Okay. Lee Newbrinley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Chair Stevens. This has all been really helpful in clarifying. I appreciate understanding those numbers, and actually that, particularly in those out years, those are substantial amounts of money, the $15 million, that's substantial. I was concerned if we were just talking about, frankly, I mean, if we were just looking at the 24-25 year and looking at the $4.5 million, I'd be concerned about pulling money out of that. And the point I would like to make, and maybe we should still think about this, but, you know, I mean, last session, in the last budget, we passed $330 million of ongoing money for homelessness. And, you know, in the 1920 biennium, we actually had a division on preventing homelessness. And I know, and I was the lead on that committee, and there was a lot of frustration. We talked about this a lot, that most of what we talked about that in committee was actually dealing with the effects of homelessness. Rarely did we actually deal with things that would prevent homelessness. And so as I look at this, as I look at the treatment side of this, hopefully that's an intervention that can happen before we get to those problems. As I look at, you know, the public awareness side of this, I look at these and I see a real potential for preventing homelessness, which is an area that we actually don't put nearly as many resources into when it comes to homelessness. So, you know, like I said, if we were talking about the $4 million, I would say, please don't do this. Please don't make this change. I understand the $15 million is a different number, but we should think about that on, you know, as we move forward, that let's make sure that we are directing those resources as we can to preventing these problems to begin with. Because, I mean, as you said, I mean, it is significant, and certainly we see it with substance use, that it's a huge problem in our homelessness population, and we certainly don't want to add to that. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate all the clarification.
Chair Stevenson.
I guess the only thing that I would say, that I agree that sort of ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure type perspective. The thing that I would note, what you heard from nonpartisan staff is, of the amount that we currently spend on problem gaming, only a very, very small amount, I think it was a couple hundred thousand, goes to that education awareness bucket. So there's a really substantial increase in this bill for that bucket, which I think is really important, particularly when we think about the, you know, people like to talk about the advertising involved in sports betting that's already occurring. The other thing I like to point out is that there's the, like, official advertising and advertising for DraftKings, but there's also the fact that anytime you turn on sports talk radio or watch a halftime show, there's a gambling tint to the conversation these days, and that's a really powerful, probably in my mind more powerful than the real advertising aspect of this. And so it's time to devote substantial resources to education and awareness around problem gaming.
To the amendment, Representative Zalesnica.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Tu, for this bill. My question, when I look at this, that I would hope you would consider is the 33% for the national education prevention of that bucket, that first 50% bucket. I think I totally understand from listening to this that we need more education on that whole part. My question is, when we look at the existing, I think from my notes, our existing DHS treatment money for gambling, for existing measures today, which this is just another slot of gambling, but it's gambling, let's be honest. So we have almost $7 million already for that. So with that being said, my suggestion would be to look at that 66% that's left in that bucket and consider, when we have an absolute epidemic right now on the EMS side, the emergency medical service ambulance, which is something the entire state needs to make sure is solid, that be considered for that, because that is exactly who is responding to addictions for the entire state. And fentanyl, for opioids, for all of our kids. I mean, we've had 1,000 fentanyl deaths. We have addiction is just in many, many forms. It generally is not in one lane. It's in multiple lanes for people. And so I am supportive of this. I want to see those pieces. I appreciate that the 50% is untouched for youth sports. I think our initiative to get people outside, to foster things when we have 40% increase of mental health, is critical. and initiating that, I appreciate that. I would just strongly suggest that we consider that 66 of what that means for Minnesota if we have a revenue stream, because EMS for our medical response is critical for this entire state, for every one of us in this room. And so knowing that we have a valid, we've invested $300 million in homelessness and housing initiatives, and we also have money for the addiction pot, which is going to treat people in multiple classifications, I think we should seriously think on that 66 for our ambulance system that is at risk. And that's just something I would like to see just considered. But I appreciate the information and the update, and I have no further questions. Thank you.
Representative Gilmer.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much for bringing this forward. I love the idea of sports betting. I'm just going to say I. Okay, I do. But just in its current form and with this amendment, a couple questions I have just in considerations just to think about is would the legalization of sports betting in Minnesota adversely affect, like our bingo, legalized things right now, bingo to pull tabs, paddle wheels. I'm trying to think of things that meat raffles, that's kind of a big deal out in rural Minnesota. Don't know if you can go know about that, but it's legal to go get yourself a steak or two and have some fun while you're at a facility or at a place of some fun things that happen there. So anyway, I'm just curious, the way that things are written, would you and Representative Garofalo be willing to work with just to make sure and ensure that these things can still happen? Because youth sports to veterans, our local fire departments. It's very, very important to me personally that some of the legal charitable gaming things that are happening right now would not be impacted by that. So that's just something I was just curious about. Would my support of this bill then hinder things that are already happening right now in that way?
Chair Stevenson, I know we are talking about 18 amendments.
Okay, yes, so. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to try and briefly answer the question. So obviously this doesn't impact, when you say can it still happen, there's no legal change to any of the things that you mentioned under this bill. I think some people have raised a concern that people will spend less on that if they have the opportunity to wager on sports. I am skeptical that that would happen. I don't know that there's a way to prove a negative in this case, except, and I almost hesitate to use this analogy, but it's the best one I can think of. When we legalized electronic pull tabs just over a decade ago, there was a lot of concern from people who made paper pull tabs that they would lose business. They thought that if given the choice, people would rather do the electronic things and their market share would go down. And it's kind of a similar logic to what people who would say, well, maybe who's going to go to the meat raffle if you can wager on NFL games on your phone. But actually, in the decade since e-pull tabs came on the scene, paper pull tab growth has accelerated. They're way more popular today than they were a decade ago. So I'm not saying that all of a sudden people are going to be flocking to the meat raffle if we legalize sports betting. I'm saying I think that they're probably not going to be impacting one another.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gilmer, any follow-up?
Yeah, so thank you so much. And as things keep moving forward, I just would love to help out in any way I can and have more conversations around this. So appreciate it. Thanks.
I don't see any more discussion to the amendment. All those in favor of adopting A18 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Abstention? The A18 amendment is now adopted. To the bill as amended, Chair Stevenson, if you wanted to add any more discussion. And members, we're going to be covering Article 2, Section 2, Subdivision 7, and Article 4, Section 2, which is in the purview of this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I've said everything I need to say.
Member discussion as amended. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, are we going to have a testifier on this as well? Should that
yes.
be done before we take the vote, or how is that going
to
work?
Yep, I was planning to go through the bill before we make the vote. I wanted to give members to discuss the bill before we bring the testifier. Any other member discussion? Hearing none, we have a testifier, Susan Tucker. If you're on, please come to the testifier table. Ms. Tucker, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members of the committee. I'm Susan Sheridan Tucker. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Alliance on Problem Gambling. We are the state affiliate to the National Council on Problem Gambling, so we are named indirectly in this bill. We are a nonprofit organization that's been dedicated to improving the lives of those affected by problem gambling through advocacy, education, training, and research. We are here, obviously, to make sure that adequate funding is provided if a sports betting bill is approved. Frankly, this is the only way that we get funding. There are no federal dollars set aside for gambling addiction. And while I listened very carefully to Mr. Drucker's presentation, I would kill for that infrastructure. We do not have anything like that in the problem gambling area. And it is a real addiction. It's a gambling disorder. It has been recognized by the DSM-5, and we as a state need to embrace that. And if we're going to pass an expansion of betting, then we also need to expand the dollars that are spent on this addiction. Our work is about education and advocacy, and we reach tens of thousands of Minnesotans each year. We are trying to cover the state. My little organization is 3.5 people, and we do our best with the funding that we have. And if increased funding is available, that would enable us to do a statewide education campaign, which currently we're really limited. The month of March is Problem Gambling Awareness Month, and I'll be spending $100,000, which is a lot of money for us, to put out a PSA that will indicate to people that gambling addiction is real and that treatment is provided. It's free in Minnesota, but we need to see this as an addiction. And so I want you to understand that there are 250,000 Minnesotans that are impacted by this addiction and 6,000 high school students, and yet we have no prevention materials in the schools right now. We go through the back door often to get our materials in front of people. And so I'm just asking you as policymakers that you see this addiction, you understand its impact on families, communities, the individual, and that additional funding is absolutely necessary because we have a lot of work to do. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Tech. Any member question? Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the total amount annually in gambling in Minnesota at this time?
Is that a question for Ms. Tech?
Mr. Chair, because the testifier pointed out there's not much funding now, and this bill is going to add some funding, so I'd just sort of like to understand how much gambling do we have now? In the bill, they've got to estimate an annual amount of gambling that'll be added and some funding, and I'd just like to know, the current gambling, there's no funding that's going to the group that is needing it. And the fact is that if there's such a need, why is this bill not addressing the current issue? So that, you're going to have 20% more gambling, so we need to increase. What are we comparably doing with the 80% we already have? I'm trying to size this because, human services is important, and the testifier brought up a great point of there. Apparently, all this current gambling that's going on, there's not the same amount of money going to the solution. So if we're saying that we need to have funding to take care of this additional gambling issue, then why aren't we also looking at comparable addressing of, you understand where I'm getting at? So I'm trying to have the data to size to understand what our component of the bill is, what's affecting the human services and our people, because I haven't heard that detail yet.
So I think that's a broad question. I don't know if Chair Stevenson or Ms. Stacker wanted to address it, because we're talking about compulsive gambling disorder in terms of how to address it. Do we have enough resources to address that issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I don't. If you're asking how much money is wagered in any form of legal gambling in Minnesota, I don't know the answer to that question. There's several different types of legalized gambling in Minnesota, from tribal casinos to charitable gaming to the lottery to wagers at our horse tracks. My understanding is that the funding that presently goes to DHS and to this organization comes from the lottery. Nope, I got that wrong. See? I'll turn it over to
Ms. Backus.
So we've been around since 2001. In 2005, we were awarded $225,000 each year from basically the lottery budget, and that amount has remained the same, has not changed. In 2013, when the electronic pull tabs were created to help pay off the debt service for the Viking Stadium, we were included in the tax rate to get 0.5%, and then DHS getting the other half. That's roughly been amounting to between $500,000 to $700,000 a year since 2014. And those are the funds that we get from the state. And in terms of how much gambling goes on, the one statistic that just blows my mind is from charitable gambling. So in $4 billion Minnesota spent on charitable gambling. So we don't know exactly on casinos, but that's a figure that we know. It's a lot of money. There's a lot of discretionary money that Minnesotans spend on gambling.
Any other question? Representative Baker.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. To the author, Representative Stevenson, again, kind of ironic today we have the addiction discussion ahead of time, and now we're doing this again, like we did last year with making things from illegal to legal and getting ready for the folks like Jeremy Drucker and I to kind of deal with issues that come out of this. And again, I know these things happen. I know that it's part of a lot of things of what we're struggling for in this committee. This committee, I know for a fact, will be dealing with a lot more things in the future when this becomes legal, with domestic issues, because people will spend all the money. It's going to create fights. It's going to create shootings, and it's going to be things that we ultimately will be dealing with in a different way down the road. And other things are doing it now. It's not just this. It's just adding more components to lifestyles and making it easy for people to get access to it. And that's what your bill is ultimately going to do. You know, I support sports gambling if people want to do it. I don't mind it. I'd rather have it if they went to a casino or a local legion and get their appetite of this. And so my first question is simply this. What is, to Representative Stevenson, why is it so important to bring this to the devices and mobile devices versus locations where we can do sports betting at a location so that the delivery model is not so in front of everybody? What is the purpose in your thinking of that?
Chair Stevenson, I know we are talking about Article 2, Section 2, Subdivision 7, and Article 4, Section 2, which I think does not address that question, but if you wanted to quickly.
But it's close to addiction. You know where I'm going with
yep.
this, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I hear that.
I'm happy to answer the question. You know, I think, I don't know that you'll find this answer satisfying, but it's what I believe, which is that it's already on the phone. We are not capable of making the decision about whether you're going to wager on sports on your phone. People wager on their sports on their phone all the time. It's very easy to do. This bill, I don't believe, makes it any easier to do. there's already rampant advertising to do it across Minnesota from national sources. What this bill does is create a regulatory framework around that activity to, one, put in what I usually refer to as consumer protections. You could also think of them as ways to try and deal with the addiction issue that don't exist in offshore websites. So, you know, whether that's the bill bans push notifications from these services. It requires a delay of 3 hours between when you place put your money in the account and when you can wager it. It has the ability to restrict someone's access voluntarily. You can put yourself on a list saying, hey, don't let, even if I ask you, don't let me gamble. Or you can be placed on there from another source. So there's a bunch of consumer protections around it. And of course, then there is the fact that we tax it and use the money to deal with the impact. So why allow mobile sports betting? It's already happening. And we should, in my view, just be honest about that and deal with it responsibly by creating consumer protections and trying to use some of the revenue for dealing with the impacts.
Representative Bay.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that. It's it is right. You know, it's there. But I think what we are doing is we're also just admitting, though, that it's going to, the advertising is going to multiply tenfold. Knowing that Minnesota is open for business officially, I think it's just going to change a lot of things where we see it on the sides of buses and grab your phone. And my concern is obviously with always the young kids who have these in the schoolrooms and classrooms. I don't, and I'm going to learn more about just the whole process about how you know how old somebody is when they got a phone in their hands. I don't really know how that's going to work. But we're bringing some really scary stuff to their devices, which I know are already there. We always talk about this around here. Social media, what's getting hold of the kids, what's getting seen with the kids. You know, so this is just a real philosophical challenge that we have to deal with here. I'm I guess one of the few that are really having this concern about the addiction side of things, because I know I've got good friends that have gone through this. They've gone through Vanguard at Project Turnabout, who's an amazing nation-leading, you know, gambling treatment center in Minnesota here that does great work. And I just know that it's only going to get much, much worse with this addition. So, you know, here we go. I think we have to get ready to deal with this, because I know it's very busy. I just wish it didn't have to be on every phone that we made it legal. Just because it's happening doesn't mean it's right. I guess that's my point. So I just want to say that to the group that knows that we're working really hard on this, and I appreciate everybody's efforts on this, because I think what I'm saying you get. I just know that we have to be honest about this, because we're creating more addictive behaviors by allowing these kind of rules. And so I just wanted to say that on the record, and I hope that we really keep looking at this if we really have to do the full expansion like we are, because it's going to come back to this table at this committee down the road. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Representative Bunny.
Thank you, Chair. I share the concerns with Representative Baker around like advertising, marketing, and youth access to youth. And so could you tell me a little bit about the prevention? I think you said you're working with 6,000 high school students, and there are no materials in that area, or?
Ms. Stockton.
Is that correct?
We are actually rolling out a toolkit March 1st that will address youth gambling and youth gaming. Again, we are not in the schools. We're not in the curriculum. So we are asking schools to, you know, upload our toolkit. And, you know, we have to go through the back door in order to get a hold of them. But the materials will be there.
Representative Vining.
Yeah, so I understand that you have a toolkit. Will there be more ramped up efforts once this, you know, once there's funding that occurs for prevention, identification, things like that for youth?
Absolutely. I would hope that we would be seeing the front door opened to this in the schools, and so that there would be more interaction between teachers and coaches and parents. We need to be talking about this just the same way that we talk to students about drug addiction, smoking, vaping, all of that. It is a peer addiction, so we need to be treating it as such.
Representative Vining.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Vice Chair Vining.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think it's going to be no surprise that I'm going to say some of what I'm going to say, but because I've had a lot of conversations with the author about this. I mean, the purview of this committee is, of course, to talk about how we handle money that's coming in to address problem gaming. That's what we do. It's why we're here. And I've been very vocal about my concerns about advertising being prevalent and what that looks like for our kids. And mostly, I think what we've been talking a lot about, and we haven't really called it that, but is normalizing this behavior and having it so prevalent and so in front of our kids, our youth, and so forth. That, and again, I'm a realist. I get that it's happening. I'm not suggesting that, and I realize that. But obviously, I've been concerned about the addictive features of applications and what fail-safes are in place to prevent problem gaming. I'm concerned about the advertising and what that means for our kids, you know, to see that look like a normal behavior to go and bet on things. Even, I know our author mentioned that, you know, when you look at a sports program, you see even the commentary implying that this is normal behavior to bet on things, right? And granted, I'm sure we could go back to biblical times and find gambling. So I'm not sure this is a new thing to fight about, but the consequences of it are real. And that is what is going to come back to this committee. The folks who are going to end up homeless, who are going to lose their life savings, the kids who, in those families who will be impacted, potential domestic violence or trauma to kids. I mean, those are all very, very real things that the money we're talking about would pay for. And I also really want to mention that, well, I understand that, you know, the idea of bringing revenue in is good, and we're being very thoughtful and planful about what we do with that money. I also want to keep in mind that on some level, we're talking about using a revenue source here to do things like pay for charitable things. And while that's charitable work is honorable, we're paying for it by someone's potential harm. And I think we're building a budget for charity based on that. And folks around here who know, for 5 years, I pounded the pavement to get up to 51% more back on the books for folks in the charitable gaming organizations. Like, that was my bill. That was what I was doing for 5 years to make sure charities got more money back. But I do think we need to be really thoughtful about how we address these issues and how this bill moves forward, because the decisions we make will have huge impact on problem gaming and the downstream effects that will come back to this committee. And so I want to say that I realize, and I want to thank the author in particular, because I know you and I have had a lot of conversations on this, and I know you have been very thoughtful and very open to those conversations. We've had some very good ones. And so I do know that you really are conscious of these things and have been very good about working with those of us who have these concerns. So I really want to commend you for that. But I did have to, was a little remiss that I felt I needed to bring this home. Thanks.
Thank you, Vice Chairman. I just wanted to ask if there's anyone in the public who wanted to briefly testify on this bill. Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just make a quick comment, or more, it's an invitation and an opening. I think one of the things that we've raised in this committee is the importance of educating youth and with curriculum right now. And we do not have statewide mandate. We do not have statewide standards on what's taught in health classes. And so that's something that we're talking about. Yeah. Just as in our cannabis bill, there was money put aside for curriculum, model curriculums on teaching about substance abuse and cannabis use for youth. And so I think maybe there's another conversation that we could have, and it's another committee stop. And it's not policy. but I know that, you know, everybody in this group really cares about our youth and the exposure, and that we're not ahead of this problem and that we're not addressing prevention. And so I think, you know, I think that can continue on. And just to make a quick comment, too, that I understand right now, you know, we keep talking about the infrastructure for mental health that doesn't exist. And I think we're also talking about the infrastructure for dealing with addictions that does not exist right now, because the money has not been put aside in our general fund for addressing addiction. I think that now with this clarity of the existence of, you know, mobile devices for sports betting, we understand that the problem is much larger and not going away. And so we need to start addressing and regulating that industry. And so I do support this bill, and I support the work that you're doing. Thank you, Zach, or Representative Stevenson.
Thank you so much, Chair Pryor. Thank you, Ms. Thacker, for your testimony and for coming in today. Chair much. Stevenson, did you have a brief, quickly closing remarks?
The only thing I'll say is I think that's an excellent idea, Chair Pryor, and I'd love to talk to you more about the idea of what we can do in the education space. Otherwise, please vote yes.
With that, I renew my motion, House File 2000, as amended, to be re-referred to State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee.
You voted on the amendment.
Pardon?
Did you vote on the amendment? Oh, yeah, you did. Never mind.
Yep, we voted, as amended. We have a motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Abstention? The motion prevails. You are on your way to state and local government. Thank you so much. Members, we don't have a hearing on the 27th, which is on Tuesday, but we'll come back on Thursday. We don't have any other agenda items. We are now adjourned.